Side 7, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jakes. Continuing on page 302.
These are the very words he spoke. My name is Martin of Redwall. You are a good beast, William Rutherwake. Help my friends to defeat evil and bring happiness back to our abbey. Do this thing for me, and the name of Holt Rutherwake will be remembered on the stones of Great Hall.
The old otter grasped Martin's paw firmly.
Tell me what to do, Martin of Redwall, and I will help you.
43. Alma the Badger Mother sat at supper, flanked by Skipper and Formole, the three of them highly amused, as Arvin and the Dibbons served the meal. Further up the table, Sister Cicely sniffed. Those babes should have been abed hours back. Skipper glanced down the table.
Trim me sails, what's the matter with the sister? She looks as if she's swallowed some of her own nettle soup.
Alma directed the otter's attention to Diggum and Gerbol, trundling a laden trolley towards them.
Pay no heed to Cicely. She's got a knot in her tail because her patients have deserted the infirmary, and she's got no beast to boss around.
Will you look at these babes? How nice of them to serve us supper.
Diggum clambered up onto the table, her tiny face creased in a serious frown, as she set about tying table napkins around the necks of Alma, Skipper, and Formole.
You'm keepin' these on. It'll save 'ee splashin' zoop all over 'ee. Don't 'ee take 'em off, or boy Oaky, oil send 'ee all oop to bed wi'out no zupper, hoor.
Gerbil ladled out hot root soup for all three, which Alma attempted to refuse, saying,
No thank you, sir. It looks a bit too spicy for me. I'll just have salad and a little nut bread, please.
The mole babe glared at the big badger mother.
You'll have what I gives 'ee, marm, and sup it all. 'Tis good for 'ee. Come on, finish et oop, and 'ee'll grow girt and strong like I. Bain't that right, Skip?
The skipper of otters nodded vigorously.
Oh, 'tis right enough, matey. I'll see she eats it all. You go and attend to the others. Sister Cicely looks famished. Serve her.
The Dibbons ambled off, pushing their serving trolley. Arvin was trying to feed a mouse babe, arguing furiously with him.
Little maggot, eat up all these scones, or gracious me, I tell Badger Mum to baff you in a bath, with lots of soap up a nose. Oh, yes.
The rebellious mouse babe flung a scone at Arvin.
No, I hain't got enough teeth to eat 'em. I'm like rocks. You makes de scones, you eat 'em.
It was at that point that the door slammed wide as Cracklin and Tansy rushed into Great Hall, shouting,
The tapestry! The tapestry! The secret's in the tapestry!
Immediately the diners deserted their seats to crowd round the abbey maids. Formole held up a huge digging claw, calling over the ensuing din,
You're missy! What be any tarpesty?
Rollo came panting in and fought his way to the front of the huddle.
"'The fifth pearl, of course,' he said. "'At least that's what the clues say.'
Arvin wriggled his way through and stood facing the tapestry.
"'Well, where a pearl, Tansy Pansy?'
Tansy tweaked the little squirrel's bushy tail.
"'We'll tell you when we find it, Nosy.'
Alma's huge voice boomed around the hall.
"'Stand back, every beast back, please. Make room for Rollo and those maids to do their job.' Move yourselves, please.
Reluctantly, the Redwallers shuffled back a pace. Alma joined Rollo.
I don't like intruding, but perhaps we can all help. How did you know the pearl is in the tapestry?
Rollo unfolded the parchment scrap, and spreading it on the floor, he demonstrated how they had solved the puzzle of the poem lines and letters to make up the word tapestry.
That's as much as we know at present, but we're convinced the fifth tier of all oceans is hidden somewhere in this tapestry.
All eyes were on the mighty needlework hanging from the wall. It depicted Martin the Warrior in the bottom right-hand corner, armored and leaning both paws on his sword hilt. The warrior had a reckless smile upon his handsome features, and all around him was a woodland scene showing vermin, some lying slain, others fleeing in all directions from the hero of Redwall. Alma read the rhyme aloud.
There is a warrior. Where is a sword? Peace did he bring, the fighting lord. Shed for him is my fifth tear. Find it in the title here, written in but a single word. An eye is an eye, until it is heard.
Formo scratched his dark-furred head.
Sure, 'tis a girt puzzlement. If any pearler be idden in em tarpisty, I don't see it. How do we find the hobjeck?
Cracklin picked up the parchment and strode back and forth in front of the tapestry. Here's how. We dismantle the poem bit by bit, eliminating the pieces we don't need, until we find the vital line.
Right. There is a warrior.
She pointed to the figure of Martin, continuing.
Where is a sword?
Formal indicated the blade that Martin leaned on.
Burr! What do it say next, missy?
Peace did he bring.
Tansy pondered for a moment.
Doesn't sound like a clue. Carry on, Cracklin. The fighting lord. No, that's not much help. What's next? Shed for him is my fifth tear.
That means Firmald gave the fifth pearl to Martin,
Rollo interrupted. Continue.
Find it in the title here.
Skipper thumped his tail thoughtfully.
Title? What title?
Arvin snorted impatiently. Marching up to the tapestry, he gestured.
There! That's a title there!
Embroidered on the bottom border of the work, right beneath the figure of the mouse, was a word. Martin. Cracklin could not conceal her excitement.
Aye, that's it. Listen to the next line. Written in but a single word. A single word. And that's it. Martin.
A buzz of conversation arose from the onlookers. Every beast seemed to be speculating and arguing with one another. Skipper was forced to roar over the hubbub to restore order.
Quiet now, silence. Stow the gab and let these maids get on with it.
Oh, sorry, Rollo, sir, and you too. What do you think?
Rollo polished his spectacles carefully.
I think we should hear the last line. Cracklin?
The squirrel maid read out the poem's final line.
An eye is an eye until it is heard.
The silence which had fallen over Great Hall deepened. Every beast stood looking at the tapestry, mentally repeating the line. Geralt limped forward from the table, where he had sat through it all, staunchly chomping away at every morsel in sight. He waved a slice of heavy fruitcake at Cracklin and Tansy.
Sure aren't none of your listening? As me old mother used to say, 'tis as plain as the paw behind your back in a fog.
Tansy folded her paws resignedly.
I thought you were going to tell us all something intelligent for a moment there.
They all pecked a few crumbs from his wing feathers.
Faith, and so I am, missy. Will you think of the line for a moment? An eye is an eye until it is heard. Does it not tell you anything?
Tansy shook her head.
Not a thing.
Geralt pointed at one of his eyes.
What, pray, is this?
Tansy's reply was swift.
An eye. It's your eye.
The owl chuckled.
Ah, the brains of the young are surely marvelous. Now tell me, what's this?
He pointed at Tansy's right eye. The hedgehog maid gave a long sigh of impatience.
It's an eye, my eye. What are you getting at?
Geralt went to a nearby table and took up a knife.
Me old mother always used to say, if you can't see with your own two eyes what's in front of them, then you're better off closing them and going to sleep. 'Tis far more restful.
As he was speaking, the owl was scratching something on the floorstones with his knife point. He pointed at it.
Now what would you say that was?
Tansy studied it for a moment.
It looks like the letter I to me.
Geralt smiled. He had made his point.
Right. You just said it. The letter I. At least that's what I heard you say. See, I point to me eye. That's the eye you can see. But you just said I. That's the I you can hear.
Arvin was first to the tapestry. He ran his paw quickly over the name Martin embroidered on the hem, and thrusting his other paw behind the hem, he ripped something away from behind the dot of the letter I and the warrior's name.
It the pearl! He yelled.
The fifth pearl fell to the floor, bounced twice on the stones, and rolled a little way, coming to a halt in front of Alma. The Badger picked up the pretty rose-colored orb. It glowed softly in the lamplight as she presented it to Tansy, saying, "I believe Geralt deserves a vote of thanks for his help." Shamefaced, Tansy shook the owl's talon gently. "Geralt, friend, forgive me for getting so snippy with you." The friendly bird blinked his great eyes. "Ah, sure. Cut us an old slice of fruitcake and you're forgiven." Cracklin swept the half-cake that was left from the table. "You deserve it all, and I'd bake your mother one twice this size if she were here." Arvin had been gradually sidling away until he was at the foot of the stairs. Suddenly Tansy caught sight of him and shouted, "The sixth clue! Arvin, bring it here this instant!" The squirrel babe did a little dance, wobbling his head comically. "Tansy, pansy, toogle-doo! I found it! The paper's mine!" Waving the scrap of parchment, which had been stitch-tacked tightly behind the tapestry to hold the pearl, Arvin fled upstairs, giggling. Rollo threw up his paws. "You two run and catch him. I'm too old for this sort of game." "Well, go on. Last one to catch Arvin is a something or other. Shall we say a baggy-bottomed beetle?" But Tansy and Cracklin were not listening. They were dashing headlong for the stairs to catch the squirrel babe. Arvin stood on a dormitory windowsill, hidden by the drape of the curtain. He wriggled in anticipation as the door slowly creaked open. Tansy popped her head in. "Arvin, are you there?" she called in a sing-song tone. A small giggle sounded as Tansy and Cracklin tip-pawed into the dormitory. Cracklin pointed silently to the moving curtain as it wriggled and flapped against the sill. Tansy smiled and called out in the same sing-song voice, "Arvin, you're hiding on the window-sill." A small giggly reply came from behind the curtain. "Tee-hee-hee." "No, Arvin not here." Cracklin whipped the curtain aside, revealing the squirrel babe grinning mischievously, the crumpled scrap of parchment held tight to his small fat stomach. Tansy injected a note of serious authority into her demand. "Give me that paper, sir, immediately."
"Hee-hee-hee. No, it mine. I found it."
Cracklin launched herself at Arvin, but he was too quick. Grabbing the curtain, he swung outward, let go, and somersaulted onto a bed. Tansy jumped upon Arvin, and immediately he stuffed the parchment into his mouth and shut it tight. Tansy shook him. "Open your mouth at once. We need that parchment." Arvin shook his head, attempting to speak.
"Oomph, mine."
Cracklin leapt to her friend's assistance.
"Right, you've asked for this, you little maggot."
Grabbing both of Arvin's footpaws, the squirrel maid tickled furiously.
"Yah-ha-ha-ha-hoo-hoo, stop it!"
Triumphantly, Tansy held up the damp scrap of parchment.
"Got it!"
Cracklin stopped tickling, only to find Arvin's footpaws thrust in her face.
"More tickles! Want more tickles, please?"
he squealed. Later that night, the three friends sat in Great Hall, taking a late supper together. In front of them lay the scallop shell, open to reveal five rose-colored pearls, and one remaining space in the soft red cloth that lined the shell case. Rollo nibbled celery and cheese turnover briefly before rubbing his paws together.
"Well, let's see the final clue. I trust the parchment was not damaged too much by that little savage stuffing it in his mouth."
Tansy spread the parchment carefully on the tabletop.
"No, it's still quite legible. I dried it off in the kitchen ovens. But treat it carefully. It's a mite crispy."
The friends read the line slowly together.
"My sixth and last tear I give unto you, when red wallers lie abed, at midnight see in full moon view the purple arrowhead. Travel east, 6 rods from the tip, to the rose that blooms ever fair. See if you can find the right hip. Turn west, and you're halfway there."
Rollo pushed away the remains of his supper, cupped his head in both paws, and leaned on the table dejectedly.
"Huh. And we thought the last 5 clues were difficult."
Cracklin stared miserably at the oak-grained pattern of the tabletop.
"Right. I don't think poor Picknum would have sorted any real information from that rhyme. And she was far brighter than I am."
Tansy yawned and stood up stretching.
I agree with both of you. But enough is enough for one night. I'm off to join all the other Redwallers who are lying abed.
The last thing Tansy heard before dropping off to sleep was the voice of Martin speaking to her.
The Abyss will find it for Picnum on the same ground where the fifth was found.
44. Ublaz stood on top of the mighty piles of timber heaped against the back walls of his palace, and peered over the wall top at the rocks, where Rasconza had agreed to meet him at dawn. There was still an hour to go before daybreak, but the Pine Marten was leaving nothing to chance this time. With his superb vision, he could make out tiny moving shapes on the low hill in the distance. Sea rats and corsairs were beginning to mass on the hilltop. Ublaz checked that his remaining 60 monitors were waiting, armed with long lances, in the courtyard behind him. To the left and right, behind the hill where the Wave Brethren waited, 2 fire arrows flared briefly in the dark skies. The Emperor's eyes glittered with fiendish delight. The trap was laid. During the night, Sagittar had secretly left the palace at the head of the entire army of Trident Rats, and at her Emperor's bidding, she had split the force and hidden them well among the hills. When he arrived, Rasconza would be walking into a well-laid trap. The massed Trident Rats would sweep down behind his wave scum and ambush them from the rear. From there, they would be driven against the back outer palace wall, where monitors could thrust down into their ranks with long spears, followed by flaming bales of dried wood and grass. A jubilant lark arose to greet daybreak, chirruping happily as she ascended the upper air, sun rays from the east making her wings almost transparent against the still blue skies. She was unaware of what was taking place on the ground below. Rasconza was of the opinion that only a fool would go unarmed to any meeting with Ublaz, and the wily fox had slid a keen-edged dagger inside his tunic. Grinning wolfishly at his captains, he strolled down from the hilltop with them.
"Sink me ship and drown me crew, would he? Well, today's the day the Emperor of San Petra gets toppled off his throne and fed to the fishes. Wait here until I give the signal, buckos. 'Tis supper in the palace for the Wave Brethren tonight. Right, I'm off. I ate to keep any beast waiting to be slain."
The Corsair Fox strode jauntily to the meeting place, where Ublaz's arrow had fallen on the previous day. Ublaz issued final orders to 4 monitors standing nearby. They were holding a long, heavy rope with thick knots at short intervals along its length.
"Lower me down gently, and leave the rope hanging over the wall. I will return fast, so be ready. When I grab the rope, haul me up with all speed. Do you understand?"
"Your mighty Nez."
Moments later, Ublaz was lowered to the ground outside the palace, and alone and unarmed, he marched forward to where Rasconza awaited him. Both beasts halted within 3 paces of each other. Since the Pine Marten had dispensed with wearing a transparent silk scarf across his eyes, Rasconza was careful to keep his gaze averted in the presence of his enemy. Rasconza was the first to break the silence.
"So then, Your Highness, I understand you want peace. Well, now, that's a bit of a turnaround for the ruler of San Petra and terror of all the seas, ain't it? Still, I suppose it makes sense, since all you've had to deal with afore was fools and lizards."
Ublaz sneered at the swaggering corsair.
"You may think you're a clever fox, but you made a big mistake the day you tried to pit wits against me. Watch."
Ublaz raised his paws high and spread them, roaring at the top of his voice,
"Attack!"
Rasconza picked a small flower and sniffed it appreciatively.
"Save your breath, Mad-Eyes. I'm the only one who'll do the attacking this day. Take a look at yonder ill. What do you see?"
An uneasy feeling began to stir within Ublaz. Something was wrong. A figure, garbed in a long cloak and hood, stepped forward from the Wave Brethren, crowded on the hill crest. Now it was Risconza's turn to shout.
"Unsheat yourself for the mighty Ublaz, matey!"
It was Sagittar. As she showed herself, tridents immediately began to bristle among the vermin horde. Rasconza's paw began slowly moving towards the dagger hidden in his tunic.
"Your trident rats have changed sides," he gloated. "They've got a new leader, me. Sagatar says to tell you Ed ain't decorating no trident on the jetty. You're finished, Ublaz.
Then whipping out his dagger, Rasconza pounced. But Ublaz was fast. He sprang to one side, and dealing the fox a smart blow on the back of his neck, he knocked the corsair flat on his face. Then he landed a swift kick to the fox's side, driving the wind out of him. Unarmed, and seeing the masked creatures pour from the hilltop towards him, Ublaz took to his heels and ran. Rasconza was tough. He leapt up and gave chase after his foe. With his paws pounding the earth like pistons, Ublaz dashed for the wall. A quick glance over his shoulder confirmed his fears. Rasconza was coming after him, and the fox could run like the wind. He was quickly closing the gap between them. Many seasons of soft living had slowed the pine marten. He was running flat out, but the fox was leaner and tougher. Even half-winded, he was twice the runner Ublaz would ever be. Increasing his pace, Rasconza raced along, dagger in paw. Ublaz made it to the wall, with Rasconza only a short distance behind him. Grabbing the knotted rope, Mad Eyes bellowed hoarsely,
"Pull! Pull me up!"
The four monitors hauled with all their might, and Ublaz shot upward. Rasconza leapt, striking out savagely with his blade. Ublaz screeched in agony as the dagger pierced his footpaw. Then he was seized by scaly claws and pulled over the wall to safety. Limping and hopping about on one footpaw, he yelled,
"Defend the walls! Hurry!"
The front ranks of Wave Brethren attempting to scale the walls were met by vicious thrusts from the monitor's lances. Sitting on the woodpile, Ublaz nursed his paw, staunching the blood with his cloak hem. He beckoned the largest monitor over.
"Zurgot, you must keep them at bay. If they breach the wall, you and your monitors are dead beasts."
The big lizard slithered her tongue in and out, nodding.
"Yar, Lord. Z-rats and corsairs have no pity on monitors. They will not enter here while we guard these walls."
Ublaz patted her scaly hide as he lied encouragingly. "We will defeat them. Lask Frildur is due back within the next day or so, with his monitors and a full vermin crew that I can bring under my will. We'll soon chase that rabble into the sea." By nightfall, the Wave Brethren had retreated from the walls and set up camps a short distance away, Rasconza's plan being to lay siege to the palace. Sea rats and corsairs, sharing a healthy fear of the great flesh-eating lizards, were only too willing to go along with the fox's scheme. Better to harass and starve Ublaz and his monitors out than face them head-on in battle. Inside the palace, Ublaz stood at his throne room window, staring out to sea as he tried to gather his thoughts. At least the Wavescom had only one seaworthy ship. The rest were without rudders and tillers, and two were without proper masts. He did not have to worry about an attack from the sea, as long as he could hold on to the timber needed for repairs. Below him the jetty lay deserted. It presented no problem at present. Suddenly the Emperor's keen eyes picked up a dark object to the east. He watched it getting closer, realization dawning on him. Wave Worm! It was Lask Frildur and the monitors, with Romska and her crew, bringing back the Abbot of Redwall as hostage. Unknowingly, Ublaz had been telling the truth to Zurgot when he had spoken to her earlier. His mad eyes lit up as he formulated a plan. Waveworm would soon be at the jetty. He would go and meet the ship, and once he had Lask, Romska, and the rest back inside his palace, he could defeat Rasconza's rabble. Gritting his teeth, Ublaz stared at the approaching vessel. He had fought against odds before and won. The Pine Marten convinced himself that his present troubles were due to the treachery and stupidity of others. This time he alone would control events. He, ruler of all oceans and lord of Sempetra, the Emperor Ublaz. If he trusted only himself and no other beast, victory over his enemies was a certainty. Abbot Dural was sick and exhausted. He had spent long days clearing the ship of dead lizard and vermin carcasses, consigning each one to the depths of the sea in silence. Weakened by lack of food, ill with loneliness and despair, the old mouse crouched in a darkened cabin. Shivering and semi-conscious, the lone passenger aboard a vessel taking him he knew not where, he did not even feel the keel grinding onto sea-washed sand and gravel as Waveworm ran unchecked, missing the jetty and nosing to a halt on the shores of Sempetra. Swathed in a dark silken cloak, Ublaz slid out of the main gates like a furtive cloud shadow, stealing by deserted taverns across the waterfront. He could not understand why Waveworm had not berthed properly alongside the jetty. It lay in the shallows, with neither anchor nor picket line to hold it. Ublaz waded out, hoping to catch the crew asleep at their posts. The first thing Ublaz noticed as he climbed aboard Waveworm was the total absence of noise, not even the snoring of crew beasts. Making his way to the forward cabins, he found one with the door hanging crazily by a hinge, its center panel shattered and bloodstained. It was empty. Dashing through the accommodations, the Pine Marten flung open doors, staring around in disbelief. Empty. All empty. Making his way aft, the first thing he noticed was the tiller, lashed in position. Then he saw the dark stains on rail and deck planking, which told their own grim tale. Death had visited the Waveworm. In a stern cabin, he found a fire brazier, and stretching his paws inside, Ublaz felt a slight warmth. Within the last day or so, some beast had managed to get a small fire going there. He checked a pan nearby, wrinkling his nose at the cold, rancid water. Then a thin, cracked voice called from the shadow of a bunk.
"We'll need more blackberries if we're to make a pie that big, Friar Higgle. Where's Teasel? She'll know where to get some."
Stealing silently across to the bunk, Ublaz lifted aside the tattered blanket. The Emperor of St. Petra found himself looking at the prone, shivering figure of Redwall's Father Abbot. 45. The logboat that had once been part of the craft Free Beast was in as good a shape as skilled paws could make it. Provisioned fully by the good otters of Ruddering Island, it was ready to face the seas again. Martin and his crew once more lay flat, pulling themselves on the thick hawser through the fantastic grotto-like tunnel with its shell-crusted ceiling and luminous blue light. When the vital wave arrived, they gave a final heave. Hot, sunlit daylight streamed in from outside as the tunnel mouth yawned wide. Like a cork, the logboat bobbed out onto the open main. William Rudderwake, his sturdy son Inbar, and several other otters had followed, and now they hung lightly on the boat's sides. The otter leader had a wooden whistle slung about his neck. He shook seawater from it and blew the whistle several times.
"What in the name of goodness is he blowing that thing for?"
Clucky whispered to Martin.
"I can't hear a bally sound from it. Chap's got a broken whistle, I'd say, what?"
"Maybe you can't hear the whistle, but the seal folk can," Martin explained to the bemused hare. "William told me they would stay in these waters round about until he had spoken with them about us." Clecky chose a large ripe peach from the supplies. Juice dribbled down his chin as he chomped into it.
"Funny business, if you ask me, old scout. Tunnels through mountains, whistles you can't hear, and what not?"
Graf nudged him sharply. "Well, we never ask you, so be quiet and wait." William sounded the whistle again. This time a dark, rounded head broke the waves a short distance south. The seal barked once, dived, and was gone. The friends sat in the logboat waiting, the otters occasionally swimming away to circle round slowly. It was over an hour before anything happened. Suddenly the waters around the logboat broke with a great whoosh, and seal folk appeared everywhere, smacking their flippers and rolling about between the waves. Halm, the massive king bull seal, broke the surface directly in front of the otter leader.
"Fear you day, Whalem."
The chieftain of Holt Rudderwake clapped his paws together.
"Many a hoo day, Halm."
"My father is saying that he hopes the king lives long," Inbar murmured to Grath.
Then Halm and William went into a long, animated discussion. Martin watched them carefully, though he understood almost nothing of what they were saying. However, now and again he heard his own name mentioned as Matan, and he figured that the word Sarmpot meant St. Petra. The logboat crew sat patiently until the discussion was over, then William held out a paw to his son.
"Help me aboard the boat. I would speak with our friend Martin."
Inbar vaulted aboard the logboat, and with Grath's help lifted the old otter clear of the water and swung him aboard. The mouse warrior listened intently as William counseled him.
"Holm says that he knows the Isle of St. Petra. It is southwest of here. No beast reads the ocean,
its tides and currents, like the king of the seal folk. He will get you there with all speed, but he says that it is a place of great danger, and he will not risk the lives of his tribe by staying there long. Once at that island, you will be alone with your crew. Be on your guard at all times, because it is a place of great evil. Tread carefully, and may fates and fortunes aid you and your five companions, Martin of Redwall. With your permission, I would make Martin's companions six, Father. William clasped his son's paw. I know you would, Inbar Trueflight. Ever since the boat arrived at our island, and you two set eyes upon another, you have been a good son, and Ruddering is a tiny rock in the ocean. It will be a good thing for you to see the world outside, knowing that you may return to your home if it is not to your liking. Go, my son, and may all your seasons be filled with happiness. Enbar nodded his head vigorously, shaking off a teardrop into the sea. He clasped his father's paw tightly. Thank you, sir. May the Holt not need another leader for seasons untold. Would you wait here while I go back for my bow and arrows? I left them on the river bank. Grath patted the weapons lying alongside her. I have them here, Enbar. Your father was not the only beast who could see that you wanted to come with us. William smiled, nodding fondly at Grath Longfletch. Take good care of each other, he said. Then the old otter slid into the water to join the other otters who had swum through the tunnel. He held up a paw to the Seal King. Get a womb, Nagara Amansal. Gitara Hom. The Seal King barked sharply, his voice echoing from the mountain. Feryun Whalem Gitara. Leaping to the logboat's trailing cables, the seal folk sent a huge bow wave spraying high as they sped off southwest. Viola tugged at Inbar's paw.
What did they say? She asked.
The big otter smiled down at the bull maid.
My father said, Go with the waves, let none harm you, ruler of waters. Go with all speed, great king.
Then Hom replied, Stay well, William. Then he told his seals, Gitara, which means go with all speed, or literally, cut the waves. Klecki, who was already selecting from the provisions for the midday meal, sniffed.
I knew that. Huh, seal lingo. Speak it like a jolly old seal, I do. You can't fool the great Hom Klecki, you know.
Grath turned, looking back at the island.
From here, you'd think it was just some straight-sided rock sticking up out of the sea. No beast had ever guess what it looks like inside.
Inbar looked up from the chunk of beeswax he was rubbing upon his bowstring to protect it.
Aye, that's what has always kept the island safe for the otters of Holt Rudderwake. Tell me, this place Redwall Abbey, what's it like to live there?
Grath borrowed the beeswax from him and began working on her bow.
I couldn't say, mate. Never been there, though I'd like to.
Viola interrupted the two otters, not attempting to hide the note of pride in her voice.
I was born and bred in the Abbey of Redwall. It's the most wonderful place you could wish to be. I'll tell you all about it.
Martin perched in the forward peak of the speeding logboat as it skimmed the sunlit waves, a fine sea spray causing him to blink as he gazed down at the Hom of Seal Folk. Shining like dark mottled glass, the great bull's sleek form cut the waters a paw's length beneath the surface, towing the boat with his seals as easily as a feather upon the breeze. Touching the hilt of the sword slung across his shoulders, the warrior mouse stared at the horizon, watching for the first glimpse of San Petra, and wondering what fate and fortune awaited them at the perilous isle of the mad-eyed Emperor Ublaz. 46. Arvin was stealing the hazelnut cream pie from beneath Tansy's nose. The young hedgehog maid knew he was, but she could not be bothered trying to stop him. Pulling dreadful, fierce faces, the squirrel babe puffed his cheeks in and out as he helped himself to her beaker of rosehip tea. Then, climbing up on the table, he performed a somersault and landed right in front of her face.
Tansy-pansy-toogle-doo! Boo!
Glum-faced and pensive, Tansy lifted him down to the floor.
Oh, toogle-doo yourself, you little nuisance. Go and play outside with the other dibbins. Go on, be off with you.
Arvin waggled his bushy tail sternly at her.
"Shouldn't talk to Arvin like that. Me a hotter warrior now. Kya! You not funny anymore. Arvin going to play."
Hopping and skipping, he bounded from Great Hall out into the warm late afternoon orchard to see what mischief he could create with his Dibbon comrades. Tansy watched him go, then turned back to the table, leaning moodily, chin and paws.
"My, my, what a long face! You look as if you just had a good dose of my warm nettle soup. What ails you, miss?"
Tansy made no reply, merely shrugging at Sister Cicely's inquiry. But Cicely was not one to give up easily. She persisted with her interrogation of the hogmaid.
"You suffered no permanent damage at Ninian's, and your friends Cracklin and Rollo seem to be in good health. Come on, Tansy, this is not like you. What's the matter?"
Tansy pushed away her plate and beaker.
"Do you know where to find the purple arrowhead, sister? Or the rose that blooms ever fair? Or the right hip, for that matter? Because if you do, I'd be pleased if you'd tell me. But otherwise I wish you'd please leave me alone. I mean no disrespect, sister, but I've got such a lot of thinking to do."
Sister Cicely sniffed rather frostily.
"As you wish, Tansy. But I hope you solve your problem, and it brightens up your disposition a bit."
Tansy rose dispiritedly from the table and wandered off towards the gatehouse. Even before she reached it, Cracklin's voice could be heard repeating the sixth rhyme aloud. "My sixth and last tear I give unto you, when red wallers lie abed, at midnight see in full moon view the purple arrowhead. Travel east, 6 rods from the tip, to the rose that blooms ever fair. See if you can find the right hip. Turn west, and you're halfway there." The gatehouse door was wide open, and Tansy walked in. Dust motes floated everywhere in the sun rays streaming through window and door frame. Rollo sat poring over old copies of Abbey records. Cracklin lay sprawled in the armchair. She looked up at Tansy and said,
"It's no use. Rollo has searched and rummaged through all the back records, and we haven't come up with a single clue."
The old recorder slammed a volume shut in a cloud of dust.
"Achoo! Oh, excuse me. Cracklin's right, though. I've been hard at it since dawn, and there's not a single mention of purple arrowheads anywhere in the records. Great seasons! Wolger's going to have a fit when he sees the mess we've made in here. He cleaned the gatehouse out only last evening. Well, missus, it looks like we're really stuck this time. If only we had one clue, just one tiny thing to help us. Time is running out. Goodness knows where the abbot is now, with Martin gone after him. And Viola still not found. She may have been seized again by rogues and vermin. We may well need those pearls for ransom. We must be ready. Remember what we said. We must find those pearls for Picknam."
Suddenly Tansy recalled the previous night. "Before I fell asleep last night, I thought I heard the voice of Martin the Warrior. He said to me, 'The abbess will find it for Picknam on the same ground where the fifth was found.' At least I think that's what he said. I can't recall anything else, because at that point I must have fallen asleep."
Cracklin hurled an armchair cushion at her friend. "You great puddin'head, Martin spoke to you last night, and you've only just thought to mention it now?"
Tansy caught the cushion and threw it back.
"Well, that's because I only recalled it now. Tell that bush-tailed buffoon, will you, Rollo?"
The old recorder took the cushion as Cracklin aimed it for another throw. He stared at them both over his glasses and said,
"Now, now, young maids, no fighting, please. Tansy's right, Cracklin. The remembrance of our dreams is often triggered by some beast saying a certain phrase. For instance, a moment ago I said that we must find those pearls for Picknam. Martin mentioned the words, 'Find it for Picknam,' and that's what caused Tansy to remember. Though it does sound rather odd, the abbess will find it for Picknam."
"Which abbess?
Redwall only has an abbot. Fates and fortunes rest favorably upon him wherever he is now. We don't have an abbess.
"But we do have a clue at last," said Tansy, who had brightened up considerably. "On the same ground where the fifth was found, we found the fifth pearl in Great Hall. Come on!"
Friar Higgle and Alma were carrying things out to the shore of the Abbey Pond. Halfway across Great Hall, laden with firewood and sweet herbs, they stopped at the sight of the three friends standing in the middle of the large chamber, looking about.
"Hi there! What are you searching for, more clues?" Alma called.
Cracklin explained about Tansy's dream to the Badger Mother, and Alma found herself looking around at the ceiling, walls, and floor.
"We must never ignore anything Martin tells us," she said. "But what are you hoping to find here?"
Rollo held up the scrap of parchment for her to see.
"A purple arrowhead. That's what it says here."
Friar Higgle took the parchment.
"Let me see that. Aye, you're right. A purple arrowhead. But you got to look for it when Redwallers lie abed, at midnight by the light of the full moon. So till then you may as well do something useful, like help us to set up supper on the pond edge. Lucky for you, there is a full moon tonight.
Supper is all as good fun on a summer night by the pond when 'tis moonlit." Gerbol, Diggum, and Arvin were in the kitchens, loading up a procession of Redwallers with food to take out to the pond's edge. Diggum made sure Tansy was well laden.
"Your marm, he be a girt strong beast. You'm be taking this cheese and yon breads. Come on, hold out he paws."
"I can't," Tansy protested vigorously. "I'm already carrying a meadow cream trifle, a pear flan, and a stack of mint wafers. Any more and I'll drop something."
The mole babe stared severely at Tansy and balanced a loaf on her head.
"There, don't run now, and coom straight back yor. I've lots more for 'ee to carry, hor I."
Tansy hid a smile from the bossy mole babe.
"A slave driver, that's what you are, Diggum."
Arvin prodded her none too gently.
"Keep a movin', you little maggot. You holdin' up the line."
Tansy tottered, trying to keep her load balanced.
"Ouch, you fiendish infant. What's that you're prodding me with?"
Arvin waggled the implement under her nose threateningly.
"It's my whip. Now keep it going, or you get more prodders."
Hurriedly, Tansy unloaded her burdens onto a table and made a grab at Arvin's whip.
"That's Fermal's old fishing rod. The rod!"
Rollo let go of a heavy cheese he was rolling. It trundled off alone across the kitchen floor.
"What rod?"
Tansy showed it to him proudly.
"This rod, Fermal's old favorite. Think of the rhyme, travel east, 6 rods from the tip. When we do have to travel east, I'll wager this is the rod we measure off with."
The recorder of Redwall chased off after his cheese, calling,
"Well done, miss. It looks like things are coming together a bit."
Firelight and full moon reflected in the waters of Redwall Abbey Pond. Every creature sat upon the sandy bank, leaving the food untouched until Alma had finished speaking.
"Friends, Redwallers all, let us not forget in the midst of this summer night's festivities the names of our good Father Abbot Durrell and young Viola Bankbowl. May the seasons protect them from harm wherever they may be this hour. Let us also keep in mind our abbey warrior, Martin. He and Clecky, with the sons of Logalog and the otter Grath, are probably out on the great waters, searching for Abbot Durrell to bring him back safely home to our abbey. And Rangipaw and her brave crew are ranging in the woods, still hunting for poor Viola. Let us wish them success in their endeavors. Strong hearts and true companions."
Every voice echoed Alma's last words. "Strong hearts and true companions." Arvin flung a piece of fruitcake in the pond.
"And a little supper for de big fish who live down dur."
A silvery flash, followed by a faint splash, told them that the female grayling had taken the squirrel babe's offering. The Redwallers took this as a good omen and cheered. Geralt sat with Skipper, Formole, and Higgle. The greedy owl grabbed the remainder of the fruitcake Arvin had broken to feed the fish, saying,
"Ah, now, don't be giving any more victuals to that scaly devil. 'Twill only make it fat and lazy. Here, Skipper, would you pass a poor bird some of that woodland puddin'?
It might do me broken wing a power or good, so it might. Forble, pour the October ale, will yer, before we all die of the drought.
Higgle laughed at the irrepressible owl, as he set his talons on a chestnut and mushroom flan.
Ho-ho! Is there anything I can do for you, sir? Mayhaps you'd like me to wipe your beak in between bites?
Gerald widened his great eyes at the friar.
Ah, sure, there's no need for that kind of talk, me good feller. But seeing as you're sitting there doing nothing, why not go out that hog-twanger thing of yours and play us a tune? As me old mother used to say, you can play dead, play sick, or play your friends false, but you better play in a tune if you can carry one.
Higgle produced the curious instrument and began tuning it on his head spikes.
I'll play if you sing. You know, Trees of the Wood?
Clearing his beak with a draught of October ale, Gerald nodded. 'Tis an old ditty Clecky and myself sang together as a trio. Cracklin grinned.
The two of you must have sounded amazing as a trio.
You start, sir, and I'll take the alternate line.
Ready? One, two. The hog-twanger struck up, and the pair sang with a will.
Abroad I strolled in the forest one day. I walked till my paws were sore weary. I heard an old missel-thrush close by me say, "Oh, here's to the woodland so cheery. There's ash and beech and rowan and oak, weepin' willow with leaves trailin' down-o. Many rowans I've known full of berries when grown, and laburnum that wears a gold crown-o. So of all the trees growin' here in the wood, tell me which is the finest and best, sir. I'll find that one ere springtime is gone, and I'll surely build me a nice nest there. There's cedar and elm and hornbeam and yew, sycamore buckthorn and alder so fine, sweet chestnut and fir and shrub elder, where grow dark berries on which I can dine. Aye, I'll find a stout tree for to make a safe nest, just like a good livin' bird should. Then me chicks will all fly, and just like I, seek a tree for themselves in the wood."
There was great applause, for Trees of the Wood is a fast and difficult song, but neither the owl nor the squirrel maid missed a note. Then Higgle played, whilst the Dibbons got up and did a bee-dance. Huge roars of laughter greeted the Abbey babes as they buzzed about, whirring their paws and jabbing the air with stubby tails. Sister Cicely retired early to her bed in the infirmary, and this gave Brother Dormal the opportunity of doing his tongue-twister. "If Sister Cicely serves some soup, she'll surely see some sup it. Sip that soup if you're sick, swig it swift, sure and slick. Should it set stiff and slimy, then suck it. If Cicely suspects that such soup has been scorned, she'll slip slyly and even the score. So if Sister persists, woe to him who resists. Cicely's certain to serve him some more." Alma held a huge paw across her mouth as she shook with laughter. Teasel upbraided Dormal playfully.
"Tut, tut, brother, 'tis just as well the good sister went to bed early. Let's hope the young'uns don't learn your rhyme, or they'll be recitin' it in Cicely's presence, if an eye knows Dibbons."
Dormal fiddled with the rope girdle of his habit, slightly chastened.
"But 'tis all in good fun. I mean the sister no real disrespect. Besides, any Redwaller who thinks they can get their tongue around my twister will have to think again if they try."
The perfect summer night continued happily. Wolger, the otter, was giving his hop-skip jig when Tansy and Cracklin noticed old Rollo dozing off. They nudged him.
"Come on, Rollo, this is no time for napping. We've got work to do in Great Hall. Let's slip away quietly, shall we?"
Noiselessly, the three friends padded into the Abbey's vast main chamber. It was deserted, and so silent they felt obliged to converse in whispers. Whilst Rollo set flint to tinder, lighting a lantern, Tansy and Cracklin gazed around. Dark, shadowy niches and recesses gave way to patches of soft, multicolored light, where the moon beamed through long-stained glass windows. Looking up towards the high-polished ceiling beams gave both Abbey maids a feeling of insignificance in the massive hall. Rollo had the lantern lit. In its golden glow he spread the parchment on an empty dining table.
"Now, where to begin? Have you got Firmall's fishing rod, Tansy?"
The hedgehog maid went to the tapestry, and from behind it she produced the rod.
I put it there this afternoon. Martin's been keeping it safe for me. Read the rhyme again, Cracklin. The squirrel maid did not need to read. She knew the rhyme by heart, because she had repeated it so often. My sixth and last tear I given to you. By that I take it Permal means us three, the searchers. Then, when red wallers lie abed, well, in normal circumstances, they'd all be in their beds now, save for the fact they're holding a moonlight feast outside. See these next two lines? Here's where the puzzle really starts. At midnight sea, in full moon view, the purple arrowhead. Lantern light glinted off Rollo's spectacles as he shook his head. There it is again, that confounded purple arrowhead. But where do we find it? Tansy had a sensible suggestion. Let's split up. I'll take one end of the hall. Cracklin, you take the other. Rollo, you can search the center here. Step by step, Tansy combed the far end of Great Hall, around sandstone columns, inspecting every stick of furniture, feeling wall hangings and peering behind them, even scrambling onto low window ledges to check the sills thoroughly. Her search proved fruitless. Then the moon went behind a cloud. Tansy could see the small golden pool made by Rollo's lantern in the dimness, and she made her way toward it. The old recorder was inspecting the east wall, unaware that the hedgehog maid was behind him. He was at the edge of a passage leading off the hall when Tansy's voice cut the silence shrilly. "Rollo, stop where you are. Don't move." The recorder froze, wondering if he was in any danger. Behind him he heard Tansy calling out, "Cracklin, come and see this." Leaving off her search, the squirrel maid came scurrying up, not knowing what to expect. Tansy was pointing to the back of Rollo's robe, just below the old back bull's neck. "What do you think of that?" Cracklin gasped in surprise. Beaming faintly luminescent purple, a perfectly shaped arrowhead was formed on the recorder's back. Rollo could stand the suspense no longer. He turned around to face them and demanded, "What is it? What's all the excitement about?" Tansy was still pointing. "Look at the front of your robe. It's there now." Rollo stared down at the purple arrowhead of light. "Ha! So 'tis. It must reflect on this wall when I'm not standing here, like this." He moved a pace to one side, leaving the spectral thing shining softly upon the wall. Adjusting his spectacles, Rollo stared upward to the apex of two curves at the top of a long, narrow side window on the west wall, high above the tapestry. "I thought so. It's the moonlight coming through that window. See, where it is pointed at the top like an arrowhead? The glass is reddish during the day, but in the moonlight it appears purple." Cracklin giggled. The whole thing struck her as rather funny. "And you couldn't see the arrowhead because it was on your back." Tansy had Firmall's fishing rod ready. "Travel east 6 rods from the tip. That's what the rhyme tells us. We're at the east wall. The only way we can go further east is down this passage." Rollo stared down the darkened passageway. "This only goes off to the cellars. But let us see how far 6 rod lengths will take us." He held the lantern high whilst Tansy and Cracklin measured off 6 lengths of the fishing rod at the same height on the wall as the arrowhead. At the end of 6 lengths, there was a wall decoration carved in relief, standing out from the stone, a single rose on a long stem rising up from the floor. Cracklin ran her paw over it. "There it is, pals, the rose that blooms ever fair, summer or winter. It doesn't matter what the season, this rose still stands halfway down the passage, carved from stone, blooming eternally. It'll never shrivel or lose a single petal." Rollo stifled a yawn. Despite the excitement, he was starting to feel drowsy. "Yes, very poetic, missy. Extremely touching. Now, will you be kind enough to get on with the next clue? When you've seen as many seasons as I have, you'll understand the value of a bed." Cracklin repeated the last 2 lines of the rhyme. "See if you can find the right hip. Turn west, and you're halfway there." Tansy seemed to be performing some kind of awkward dance step. Rollo held up the lantern and peered at her curiously. "What in the name of fur and feathers do you think you're up to?" he said.
The hedgehog maid continued with her strange maneuver. "Well, I found my right hip, and now I'm turning west. Why?" The old recorder slid down the wall into a sitting position. "Oh, nothing. You continue with your dance. Cracklin and I will concentrate on the carving. See? Halfway up the stem is a leaf either side, and beneath each leaf is carved a rose hip." Tansy stopped her quaint movements.
"Rose hips?"
Rollo nodded. "Aye, rose hips, you know. Those round things the size of a plum, tapered at one end. You'd usually see them after the roses have bloomed and faded. We make rose hip syrup from them." Cracklin grasped the rose hip on the right side of the stem.
"Shall I turn it to the west and see what happens?"
she asked breathlessly. Rollo smiled wearily. "Please do, miss." Cracklin turned the rose hip. It budged slightly, but nothing else happened. She turned to Tansy.
"What do you think I should do now?"
The hedgehog maid bounded forward.
"Keep turning as hard as you can, and I'll give it a good shove."
As Cracklin struggled to turn the stone protrusion a bit more, Tansy hurled herself at the wall. Her body struck the stone, and a portion of it began moving inward. She pushed harder. This time it made a grating noise and opened completely. The three friends found themselves staring into a small dark room. Picking up the lantern from the floor, Cracklin entered. Tansy and Rollo followed her in. They moved together towards the room's single piece of furniture, a small angler's stool made from canvas and strips of wood. On the seat of the stool, the lantern light revealed a tiny box made from yew wood. Rollo picked it up and opened it. 47. It was still dark, humid, and windless. The Halm of the Seal Folk gave a quick flick of his head and tossed the rope he had been pulling back into the logboat. Martin and his crew had been standing ready for hours, since the first glimpse of San Petra loomed upon the night horizon. Klecki leapt overboard into the shallows.
"So this is the place, eh?"
he said, his voice booming from the high hills surrounding them.
"Jolly good work, you seal chaps."
Martin was alongside him swiftly, his paw clamping tightly over the hare's mouth.
"Keep your voice down. No need to advertise our arrival."
Inbar Trueflight held a brief conversation with the Seal King before joining Grath and Martin on the sandy beach of the small cove where they had landed. "The Halm can no longer help us now. He is worried about the young ones of his tribe being in these waters. They are leaving." Martin bowed, clapping his paws gently at the Seal King.
"Gatara, Halm! Menyahuday!"
Blinking his dark round eyes, the Seal King snuffled gently. "Menyahuday, Halm, Martin!" There was a quick flurry of water, and the Seal Folk disappeared into the night-darkened seas. Standing on the hilltop overlooking the cove, Martin issued instructions to his crew.
"There's still a few hours left until dawn. We'd better take a look around. I think we've landed on the east side of this island, so we'll meet back here at noon. Inbar, Grath, you take Viola with you. Travel northwest and see what you can find. Klecki, Plog, Welko, come with me. We'll travel southwest. I've no need to tell you all to be careful. Travel silent and stay low. Make your way back here by following the coastline. That way we'll have covered most of the island between us. Any questions?"
What time's food at, old scout?"
Martin shook his head in bewilderment at the irrepressible hare.
"Klecki, stop thinking of how to keep your stomach full, and give a little thought to keeping your skin in one piece."
The hare saluted smartly, dipping both ears.
"Forget jolly old Tom. Keep skin in one piece. Gotcha, sir."
They split off into two groups and set off across the island. Ublaz Mad Eyes was worried. His hopes of getting reinforcements on Waveworm's return were dashed. All his force consisted of now was less than 60 monitors, since random sniping from the Wave Brethren had accounted for several lizards who had been slain by arrows and spears. The time for talking was gone. There would be no further communication with Rascanza, no more double-dealing. It was war to the finish, and now Ublaz was under siege. a virtual prisoner in his own palace. Ublaz strode across his throne room to the corner where he had chained the abbot and watched him. Durrell tugged feebly at the manacled chain that hung from a ring in the wall. He was lying on a bed of rushes, a bowl of water and a piece of dried fish nearby. Still delirious, the old mouse rambled on, half-conscious and unaware of both his surroundings and the pine marten who stood over him.
"Wolger, will you help me and Brother Dormal? All this fruit has to be gathered in before winter, and it's frosty already. I can feel the cold. Let go of my football, little one. We must harvest all that good fruit from our orchard before it perishes."
He continued tugging at the chain that held his footpaw. Ublaz turned callously away and went to lean on the windowsill. "Less than 70 lizards and a crazy old mouse," he muttered to himself. "One ship, and not a sea rat under my command. Oh, Rasganza, fox, give me time to think and I will dance upon your grave." Striding regally over to a burnished metal mirror plate set in the wall, Ublaz stared at his reflection. The strange eyes narrowed and widened alternately as his voice rose shrilly. "I am Lord of the Oceans, Emperor of Sempetra. I, Ublaz, if I had the tears of all oceans now, they would be set in my crown, all 6 of them, wondrous rose-colored pearls. I would don my green silk mantle, or maybe the black one with gold trim. Then I would walk out among those tavern rats, those wave scum. I would stare at them, snare them with my gaze. Then they would bow to me, salute me, because they would know who I am, Ublaz." The Emperor's current monitor general, Zergot, entered the throne room.
"Mighty Nez, they are gathering for another attack on the walls. Do we use the bales of fire to throw down on them?"
Ublaz paced up and down in front of the impassive lizard.
"Attacking again, eh? No, don't use the fire bales yet. Throw stones down on them. And tell your monitors to use their long spears."
Zergot flickered her long dark tongue in and out, her eyes straying to the shackled abbot.
"We cannot hold them off forever with spears and stones, Lord. There are too many of them."
Ublaz grabbed the abbot's water bowl and flung it at Zergot.
"You'll hold them off as long as I say you will," he shouted, his voice hoarse with rage. "Insolent reptile! Without my palace walls to keep you and your lizards safe, you would all be fish bait by now. Get out! Out!"
Camped in the foothills at the edge of the sunny plain, Rasganza was completely at ease. A sail canvas afforded him shade, fruit abounded on the island, and fish, like the birds of the air, were plentiful. He sat with his captains, watching the latest assault on the palace rear walls. Dedgut, the ferret captain, dipped his breaker in a cask of seaweed grog, which had been plundered from the deserted taverns lining the harbor. He filled a second beaker for Rasganza.
"Wet your whistle with that, matey. It is going to be a long, hot day."
Sipping the grog, Rasganza winked roguishly at his captains.
"Well, we got all the time we like, ain't we, mates?"
Buckla flung away a half-eaten fish, chuckling wickedly.
"Aye, and we don't have nowhere special to go, do we? Ha har har."
Grewjaw, the stoat captain, pointed a rusty cutlass at the high walls in front of them.
"No place ceptin' the palace. Wouldn't you think old Mad Eyes had come out and welcome us? 'Tain't good manners to ignore the guests when you've got company. Ho, ho, ho."
Laughing heartily, the Wave Brethren commanders watched their fighters harassing the hard-pushed monitors. Sea rats and corsairs would strike suddenly, raining arrows, spears, and slingstones on the lizards. When the monitors grouped at that point to retaliate, the wave scum would drop back, regroup, and attack in a different place. Relying only on their long spears and rock rubble to tip down on the foe beast, the great lizards were hard-pressed. Guja, the steers rat, and a score of others stayed in the middle distance, well out of rock and spear range, and constantly sniped with arrows at the frustrated monitors. The traitor Sagatar and her trident rats kept watch from the low hills to the south side of the walls. They scouted the palace from a vantage point, reporting any undue movement or fresh tactic back to the captains. Rasganza was a good and wily leader. His strategy was working well. Idly, he turned to Dedgut. "They've had enough for now, mate," he said, indicating the group who were attacking the wall. "Call them off. I'll send another gang at them tonight. That'll keep those lizards up on their paws and stop them getting any sleep. Once we've taken that back wall, they'll retreat inside the palace. That's when the battle will get fierce and bloody, but they'll be well worn down by then." Deadgut saluted and trotted off to carry out the instruction. Valtor and Concho drew close to Rascanza's side.
"Can we have first crack at the timber piled behind the wall, Captain? That wood is worth its weight in gold."
The fox threw his paws about their shoulders.
"Har, don't you fret, messmates. There'll be timber enough for every beast. Sagatar says there's enough wood piled back of that wall to build 3 ships.
Baltur's eyes shone longingly.
"Never mind building 3 ships. We'll have enough timber to repair our own vessels. Then we'll be a proper fleet again. Corsairs and sea rats, with their own island and their own fleet."
Rascanza laughed, hugging both beasts tight.
"Ha, ha, ha! I told you to stick with me, mates. Ahoy! What's that? Who's messing about back there?"
Klecki had stolen up on the camp from behind. Lying on the slope of a sandy dune, he had heard all that went on between the fox and his captains. But the loose sand had shifted, and unable to stop himself, the hare had rolled down the slope and landed against the back of the canvas awning with a bump. Hearing Rascanza calling, Klecki decided it was not a good place to be. Thinking quickly, the long-legged hare lashed out several times with his strong footpaws, knocking the canvas sunshade down on top of the corsairs. Then he scrambled upright, dug in his paws, and took off east, with shouts ringing in his ears as Rascanza and his captains threw aside the fallen awning.
"Ahoy, mates! 'Tis a big rabbit! Get him!"
Klecki paused indignantly on the hilltop for a fleeting moment.
"Big rabbit? Cheeky blighter! Must need his belly eyes seeing to. Big rabbit, indeed. Huh! If you weren't a fox, I'd say you were a frog's uncle, sir, what?"
An arrow hissed into the sand close by. Klecki took off. Grewjaw and 6 others gave chase, panting to each other as they toiled uphill.
"I never knew there was rabbits hereabouts." "Me neither, mate. Look at him go. He can run all right. I hopes that rabbit's got plenty of family and friends. Rabbits is good eatin'. I'm partial to roasted rabbit."
Klecki was not especially bothered by the pursuers, who were slow and clumsy. He led them a merry dance over plain and hill, knowing that he was leading them away from Martin, Plog, and Welko, who had circled down to the harbor area. Puffing and panting, the exhausted wave brethren pressed on doggedly after the strange beast. Grewjaw held his aching side.
"Ahoy, mates! Hold up! Where's the lop-eared swab gone?"
Completely out of breath, they halted, looking about them. Klecki popped up a short distance away.
"I say, mind who you call a lop-eared swab, you carrot-nosed bilge swiller. Come on, chaps, keep up. No lagging behind, what?"
A sea rat flung his sword, hoping to stick Klecki. It fell on empty ground. The hare had vanished again. He emerged a moment later, off to the left of the hunting party.
"You there, baggy belly. I'll bet your dear old mom and dad wouldn't be too proud of you, chucking your sword about like that."
He disappeared once more.
Grewjaw wiped his slavering mouth. "Where in the name of blood and plunder has that rabbit gone?"
Klecki materialized, this time to their right, and pointed an ear sternly at Grewjaw.
"I say, watch your language, sir. There might be maidens or young'uns of a tender disposition in the area. Too much grog and not enough healthy exercise and clean living, that's your problem. Right, come on, chaps. Off we jolly well go again."
Paw-sore and panting, but thoroughly enraged, they chased after their elusive quarry.
At one point, Klecki appeared right in the middle of the group, running along with them. He tapped a sea rat on the back and issued instructions to him.
"You're running all wrong, old lad. More thrust on the back paw, and don't flail the tail about so much. Keep it well tucked in. That's the style. Well done, what? 2 points to this feller."
Dropping to the back of the group, he clipped another sea rat smartly across both ears.
"Come on, laddie buck. Keep up. No slacking now. Up 2, 3, up 2, 3, up, up, up. That's the ticket."
Vanishing, appearing, dodging, ducking, and weaving, Klecki peppered the fuming wave brethren with alternate insults and advice as he led them where he pleased. 48. High noon sun beat down on the weathered planks of the jetty. The harbor of San Petra lay silent and shimmering under a blue tropical sky. Flanked by Plog and Welko, with their shrew rapiers drawn, Martin unslung his sword and hurried across the strand to where the ship bobbed calmly on a lazily swelling tide. Checking left and right, and turning often to stare back at the palace upon the escarpment, the three friends made their way into the shallows.
"This is the ship," said the warrior mouse, keeping his voice low. "I remember its name, Waveworm.
Either the abbot is aboard here, or somewhere on this island, probably in that big building up on the rock.
Stay here and keep watch. I'm going aboard to take a look around."
Gripping the sword blade between his teeth, Martin began hauling himself paw over paw up a head rope, hanging from the forward peak. Waist-deep in warm, shallow seawater, the shrews waited. Plog held up a paw to his ear, leaning inland.
"Listen, can you hear anything?"
Welko waded closer inshore, cocking his head.
"Aye, sounds like shouting or fighting. I think maybe 'tis coming from somewheres round that big building up there."
Faintly the noise of warfare drifted on the still air. Plog looked at Welko and shrugged.
Some beasts having a tussle, that's plain. "Hi, you two. Come aboard. The ship's empty."
Martin threw an extra rope line over the side so the brothers could board more quickly. Sheathing their rapiers, they clambered onto the Waveworm. Plog pointed over to the palace.
"Seems to be a bit of trouble over that way, Martin."
The warrior mouse studied the palace a moment, then leapt into sudden action.
"Aye, and there's a bit of trouble headed this way. Grab some of them long poles there, you two. We're about to steal a ship and sail off. Hurry, there's no time to lose."
Ublaz had watched Martin and the two shrews from his throne room window, puzzled by the appearance of strange beasts upon his island, but not for long. When he saw them climb aboard Waveworm, the Emperor quickly summoned four monitors. Ublaz had been keeping Waveworm as a standby in the event that he had to leave the island in a hurry. Now, in danger of losing his vessel, he dashed down to the main door with the four lizards scurrying in his wake. They were just out of the door when the mouse who carried a great sword happened to look up and see them. With Martin punting his long pole hard on the forward starboard, and the shrews doing the same on the port side, at Waveworm's aft end, the ship began swinging round to face seaward. Martin joined his friends at the stern end, noting that the tiller was lashed, holding the vessel to head straight out. Between the three of them, they poled furiously, watching the land slip away as she caught the gentle swell.
"Well done, mates," Martin gasped. "See if you can loose some sail to catch the breeze further out. Good job I looked up and noticed those creatures, or they'd have boarded and taken us by surprise."
Ublaz dashed along the jetty. Shaking with rage, he stood wordlessly, watching Waveworm coast by, safely out of his reach. At that moment, the Pine Martin would have given anything for a bow and arrows. He glared at the mouse, a strange-looking creature, stern and solid, and obviously a warrior by the splendid blade he carried. Silently the mouse stared back at him, not the least bit afraid of the mad-eyed Emperor. The four monitors stood watching dumbly as canvas billowed out and the sails caught the breeze. Then something happened to the Pine Martin that had never occurred in all his seasons. He found that his hypnotic power had no effect on the mouse. Piercingly, wildly, he glared at the stranger, but the warrior never budged a fraction. Just remained leaning coolly over the rail, staring back, matching Ublaz eye to eye, until his adversary was forced to look away. However, Martin kept watching the receding figure of his enemy, knowing that this was the beast he would have to reckon with. Evening shades were falling fast over the small cove on the east of San Petra. Grath and Inbar were resting on the grassy slope when Viola came and shook them.
"There's a ship coming this way. Look!"
Welko waved to them from the forepeak of Waveworm.
"Ahoy, mateys! Do you like our new ship? No more logboats for us."
Grath took the heaving line which Plog threw to her and made it fast to a rock. Martin and the shrews waded ashore, Martin calling to Inbar.
"Is Clucky back yet?" "We lost touch with him over the other side of the island. He probably found something to eat."
"Don't you worry about Mr. Clucky,"
Viola giggled. "He can take care of himself." There was still plenty of provisions left in the logboat. So as night fell, Viola and the two shrews lit a fire, whilst Martin and Inbar began preparing a meal. Immediately, as a vegetable stew began to simmer, a jovial voice hailed them from the darkness.
"What ho! The jolly old camp! Roving fighter returning with tales of derring do, high adventure, and all that nonsense, what?"
The friends burst out laughing, and Viola called back.
"I had an idea you'd arrive as soon as supper was ready, you great furry food bag. Where have you been?"
Clecky ventured into the firelight, pulling behind him a sea rat tied up with his own belt.
"Evening, chaps. I say, that smells rather nice. By the by, I don't suppose you've met this vile felon. Captive of mine. Says his name's Gouja." "Say hello to the nice creatures, Gouja."
The sea rat, who sported an enormous lump on his head, stood glaring at them. Clecky pushed him so he fell into a sitting position.
"Old Gouja's the strong silent type, don't you know? Come on, you jolly old sulker. No hard feelings, what? Say hello to the chaps. Don't sit there like a lovelorn limpet. Speak up."
Martin ladled stew into a deep shell and passed it to Clecky. "Leave him for the moment. Let's have supper in peace. Later on he can talk. There's a lot of information we need about this island, the big building I saw today, and what both sides are fighting about. I'm sure Gouja can tell us that." Baring his yellowed teeth, the sea rat spat on the ground.
"I ain't talking to no beast, and you can't make me."
With startling speed, Grath leapt over the fire, landed in a crouch facing Gouja, and fixed him eye to eye. Her voice was dangerous, like the growl of thunder on a far horizon.
"Keep looking at me, scum, and don't dare blink. I am Grath Longfletch of Holt Lutra, the only one of my tribe left alive after your kind visited my home. When I've eaten me victuals, you'll talk to me. In fact, I'll wager you'll make a babbling brook seem dumb by the time I'm finished with you."
Wide-eyed with fright, Gouja whined fearfully to Martin.
"I'll talk to you. I'll tell everything you needs to know. But keep this otter away from me. I beg your please."
The sea rat winced as Clecky patted the bump on his head.
"That's the ticket, me hearty. We'll even let you sing us an horrible pirate ditty if you behave nicely, what?"
While they ate supper, Inbar told Martin of what Grath, Viola, and himself had discovered that day. "We ranged as far as the northwest coast, and found a steep cove, much bigger than this one. 6 vessels were berthed there, big ships, each one about the size of the craft you captured, Martin. There were about 5 or 6 vermin guarding them. We figured that there must be lots more on this isle to crew the ships, though." Clecky tore off a hunk of barley bread from a big flat loaf.
"Oh, I found those blighters. There's a great crowd of 'em, pasting the blue blazes out of a pack of those lizard types, who seem to be defending the back walls of the palace. I overheard 'em saying it belongs to a chap called Mad Eyes. Anyhow, the jolly old vermin want the palace, and the timber stacked behind the back wall, to repair their ships. But Mad Eyes isn't too keen on letting 'em have either. The blighters keeping tight hold of both, like a squirrel babe holding on to a candied chestnut."
Martin contributed his intelligence to the hares.
"Aye, I've seen that palace from the front. There's a harbor with a jetty there. Saw Mad Eyes, too. In fact, we saw each other. I'm pretty certain that he's holding Abbot Durrell prisoner in that palace. I'll get all the information I can out of the sea rat, and then we'll have a better idea of a rescue plan."
Whilst Martin questioned the prisoner, his friends sat around the fire on the still tropic night. Viola lay on her back, gazing up at the velvety vault of dark skies, scattered with countless stars and a half-moon. The Volmaid marveled at the sight of random comets, trailing fiery trails across the wide infinity in brief glory. Inbar and Grath moved away from the roisterous snores of Clecky and the two shrews. The son of Walyam watched Waveworm tilt into a slight list as the ebbing tide allowed her keel to rest in the shallows, and said,
"Never have I seen such hatred on any face as I saw when you faced that sea rat this evening, Grath."
The powerful otter glanced sideways at her friend.
"And I never told you my story. When I was hunting alone,
I formed the whole of my tale into a poem, because I don't ever want to forget, nor want the otter people to. Would you like to hear it? Inbar nodded. I'd be honored if you'd say it for me. Grath's voice rose and fell, sometimes quivering, often ringing like a brazen bell, as she recited the verses. The words burned themselves into Inbar's memory. Sad winds sweep the shores, near a place called Holt Lutra, where first I saw daylight the day I was born, and the lone seabirds call o'er the grave of them all, whilst my tears mingle into the seas as I mourn. For those tears of all oceans, six pearls like pink rosebuds, once plucked from the waters beneath the deep main. O my father and mother, dear sisters and brothers, in the gray light of dawn all my family were slain. They sailed in by night dark, those cold, heartless vermin, their pity as scant as the midwinter's breath. Then, laughing and jeering, as slashing and spearing, my kinfolk were slaughtered by wave scum to death. But their greatest mistake was, they left Lutra's daughter. I swore then an oath that the seasons would show my green arrows flying and sea vermin dying, cursing with their last breath the swift song of my bow. So vengeance will drive me, as long as my paw's strong, to sharpen a shaft and my bowstring to stretch. The price vermin paid for six pearls from a raid is that death bears the same name as I, Grath Longfletch. Inbar Trueflight turned slowly to look at his companion. That is a tragic and terrible tale, Grath. I see now how close to death that sea rat came when you spoke to him. Grath plucked an arrow from her quiver and sighted down its shaft, testing it for straightness. Since I laid my family to rest and went roving, many corsairs and sea rats have fallen to these arrows of mine. Her friend shook his huge head in wonderment. I've never known killing or war. Ruddering Isle is a place touched only by good order and peace. You've seen my archery skills. I'm a dead shot with bow and arrow. But never did I aim at a living thing. Ramming the arrow back into its quiver, Grath stood upright. I was the same till the wave scum came to our holt on the far north shore. But I've learned different, mate. Any creature holding out the paw of peace to sea rats or corsairs will get it chopped off by a sword. That's the lesson I've been taught, and you'll learn the same soon. So get used to it. I'm going to sleep now. Turning on her footpaw, she stalked off to her place by the fire. Inbar remained seated, staring at his wide, powerful paws. His father had told him that the outside world was a different place. He was not sure he was going to like the difference. Klecki opened one eye. In the soft dawn light, he found himself staring at a brightly hued beetle perched upon his nose. With a twitch and a puff of breath from the side of his mouth, he dislodged the insect, blinking disdainfully at it as it trundled off through the sand and grass.
Cheeky-faced object! Go and perch on some other beast's hooter!
No blinkin' respect, that's the trouble with beetles.
I say, do I smell breckers? Jolly good show, you chaps!
Plog, Welko, and Viola had been up and about since the crack of dawn. They had rekindled the fire and made a meal. Klecki sat up, waggling his ears in anticipation as Viola served him. Hot shrew cakes, honey, fruit salad, and melon juice, she said. We thought you deserved a break from cooking. Anyhow, you always cook too much, so that you can have three helpings. Grath was sitting between Martin and Inbar, having breakfast. Suddenly she jumped up, looking left and right, reaching for her bow.
Where's the sea rat? He must have escaped.
Welko allayed her fears quickly. Old Gouge's safe, Marm, don't you fret. Me and Plog couldn't stand looking at his ugly, miserable mug, so we took him down aboard the ship and secured him all snug and tight, with a fetter and chain stapled to the mainmast. Even gave him victuals, too. Martin smiled and winked at the shrew. Well done. 'Tis poetic justice, really.
I'll wager that was the same chain they used to keep the abbot prisoner on the voyage. After breakfast, Martin called them all to a council of war. Drawing on the sandy ground with his sword point, he illustrated a plan he had formed. Right. Here we are, and here's the palace, which is under attack. Now, I'm certain Abbot Durrell is somewhere in that building, and it's our job to free him and get away from this island. So here's what I propose. If we're to get into the palace, we must create a diversion, so we're not overrun by lizards or whatever beasts are up there. Listen carefully. You all have a vital part to play in this scheme, and it's highly dangerous, and we run a great risk of losing our lives. Any beast who feels they cannot take part in my plan, speak now. I'll understand. Viola answered for them all. We came here to free our father Abbot and take him home to Redwall. If our enemies were 10 times the number they are now, we would never back down, never. Tell us your plan, Martin, sir. Every beast here is with you to the death. Tropical morning sunlight beat down on the cove where Waveworm lay, east of San Petra. Martin's great sword slashed paths and patterns in the earth, as his crew sat listening to the daring idea unfold. Stirred by the excitement of it all, Plog drew his short rapier, glaring resolutely towards the west coast of the island. Aye, 'tis perilous, that's sure. But if I live through this, and it'll make a great tale to tell around the fire on a winter's night, to McGranshrews and the seasons to come, matey. 49. Rollo emptied the contents of the little U-box out onto the seat of the angler's stool. Cracklin held the lantern close so they could see clearly in the darkened chamber. Dry and crisp, light as thistledown after its long sojourn in the box, the dried carcass of a bee lay on the stool. Tansy stared at it, her voice shrill with disappointment. A dead bee. Is that all? The old recorder peered into the box, blew into it, and poked a claw about inside. Well, there's nothing else in here. But I expected something like this. Tell me the end of the poem again, Cracklin. End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.